sorry for the delay. We've had an audio-visual problem, which we haven't solved, but we are going to ignore. So, but we had hoped to do better. For those, any of you who had come with the idea of seeing Roger Penrose in the chair, as you see from the later statement on the screen, he isn't here, and you have to make do with me. But any disappointment that you have will be amply compensated, I'm sure, by the lecture you're going to hear. To justify my presence in the chair, I'd like to put a little historical framework. In 1950, for those who can remember that far back, I joined the mathematics department, which included several algebraic geometers. It seemed to an outsider like me a very gentlemanly occupation, very H.L. Baker-ish, if you remember those books. But as I stayed there, things soon changed. Some of my colleagues took me along to hear Grothendieck talk at the 1957 Edinburgh International Conference on the cohomology of abstract algebraic varieties. And even with as little understanding as I derived from that, I realized that he was bringing a deep geometrical insight to things. And it seems surprising in retrospect to find categories coming in at the same time. But now the application of these ideas have spread much farther, and we have the good fortune to hear about the impact on mathematical physics from Professor Pierre Cartier. He tells me that he's really a generalist and has been a professor at the Institut des Hautes Etudes Scientifiques since 1971. He slightly changed his title to New Symmetries in Mathematics and Physics. Professor Cartier.
Thank you. For a number of years, it was quite uncommon for a mathematician to speak about problems in mathematical physics, except in some small circles. And people doing mathematical physics had a tendency to focus on the method of Hilbert spaces, algebra of operators, and so on. And the geometrical background was not considered as basically important. The basic geometry that is needed to model physics was a so-called Minkowski spacetime, whose geometry is fascinating but quite elementary, a quite natural descendant to Euclidean geometry, despite the fact that there are some odd phenomena. But it was considered that the progress in mathematical physics would come basically from a better understanding of algebra of operators or partial differential equations, spectral theory, and so on. That means method to solve equation and to derive from them exact knowledge of the property of atomic or molecular spectra. That was so not so long ago, and that was also the time where, as I said, many mathematicians would be rather snobbish about mathematical physics. The big trait of the time was algebraic geometry or various forms of geometry, not only algebraic geometry. And we had a few days ago a celebration of the 100th anniversary of the birth of André Weil, who was certainly a master of the 20th century. And what was praised from him was his contribution to number theory, which it certainly deserved. And I myself had the task to explain his work in geometry. But André Weil himself has written a kind of autobiography so-called years of apprenticeship, which is certainly, as my wife mentioned to him, a good novel, she said. Andre, you wrote a good novel. And I don't know whether he was really pleased by that, but he was, because he pretended to explain his life, at least part of his life. And he has a funny comment at some point. He said, in 1926, I visited Göttingen, at that time one of the strongholds of the world mathematics, under the leadership of Hilbert and other people around him. And one told me later on that something happened in 1926 about physics in Göttingen. That the year where Born, Heisenberg, and other people invented the quantum mechanics that we know now, compared to the old so-called old quantum theory. But when I asked him, were you serious when you wrote that? He said, oh yes, I was serious. And that's just to say that we are coming back from a situation which was quite desperate at some point. Now, among one of the certainly great geometers of, well, many great geometers in the 20th century, I would certainly name André Weil, who was not only a geometer, but also did a lot of contribution to number theory. And I could mention things in Chern, Chinese geometer who just passed away, and who is credited for the so-called Chern classes, which are famous construction in geometry. And but Grothendieck, as you heard, is certainly at the same level as his geometers. We will not discuss ranking top people, and it's no point. But Grothendieck, at least by the number of pages published by Grothendieck, is certainly overwhelmed his two competitors. And Grothendieck is certainly one of the inventors of the modern algebraic geometry, but not only that, he had a very broad view of problem in algebraic geometry, and even if he was not himself a specialist in number theory, he always, devised his method in such a way that they could be applied to number theory and to give progress in number theory. And indeed, the most recent progress in number theory, for instance, the one leading to the solution of the so-called Fermat theorem, or rather Fermat problem by Andrew Weitz, were highly based on the preliminary step done by Grothendieck. But if André Weil did not know that in 1926 something happened in world physics at the place where he was visiting, Grothendieck was even stronger than that. To him, out of his own personal experience, out of his own philosophy, there was one unbeatable equation, physics equal Hiroshima disaster. And you could say also Chernobyl disaster, to add Chernobyl to Hiroshima. At the time, Chernobyl did not exist. So to him, the main development in the physics has been the disaster of the military use of the atomic energy and the atom bomb. So he would not retreat from that position, and he would say that he was very much influenced by what George Hardy said, that Hardy was so proud to work in mathematics because mathematics was the only useless science. Well, you are all familiar with the word of Hardy, and I will not repeat them, but just to say that this kind of philosophical, this kind of behavior was well developed among many mathematicians, even among the greatest mathematicians of the 20th century. And so it would certainly be a surprise to Grothendieck that his methods were invented to serve a useless science have now been brought to bear in the development, most modern development on mathematical physics. So what I will tell about is the rather unexpected connection of the work of Grothendieck on one side, which is pure mathematics, and the work of Alain Kohn, who started as a mathematician and gradually moved to mathematical physics, and even to theoretical physics. You know, the borderline between mathematical physics and theoretical physics is thin, and you can say that mathematical physics is a useless part of theoretical physics, in a certain sense. That means that the part where you are more interested in the logical strengths, logical coherence, mathematical coherence, than just having your computer bring you a sequence of numbers, a set of numbers. But the border is thin. And the experience of many centuries is that, if the border is too strongly delineated, it's damaging for both sides, and that the fence has not to be too high. Well, the fence also between mathematics and mathematical physics has not been too high. And everyone laments the time where Poincaré was respected as one of the greatest mathematicians of his time, was also the god of mathematical physics, and for many, many years his chair was named mathematical physics. Okay, so after all this preliminary, I want to say a few things. My main purpose is a rather innocent looking problem. What is a point? Well, a point, it's nothing really. And I refer you to a paper I've published some years ago in the Bulletin of American Mathematical Society, which is called A Mad Day's Work, where I have been analyzing the notion of point from a mathematical and physical point and philosophical point of view. And I will repeat some of my findings there. And I will say that, of course, a point looks nothing, and that to spend too much time on a point would be futile, but it's not so. And basically, my thesis will be that a point which has no structure, no dimension, according to Euclid's definition, should not have any kind of inner structure, and so any kind of symmetry. How can you define the symmetry if you have nothing to compare inside a point, at the interior of a point? But the main message of Grothendieck is that an outcome of the theory of Grothendieck is that symmetry of a point, there are many ways to interpret this, the symmetry of a point form a group which is highly valuable and rather unexpectedly is quite closely connected to some group which has been introduced by Kohn and Kreimer some years ago as an extension of previous work in mathematical physics about the so-called renormalization group. Come to that later. And there is a strong suspicion that these two aspects, what Grothendieck called the motivic Galois group, which is basically the symmetry of a point, properly interpreted, and the renormalization group of physics, which can be interpreted as a group of symmetry of the constant of physics. How can constant be running? But they are running. Okay, constant, so a symmetry group, geometrical flow of the of the physical constant. And that these two things are just two aspects of the same picture. That's what's still in the making. I made a prediction about 6 or 7 years ago that has inspired enough of work, mostly by Kohn and his collaborators, and partly also to me with my collaborators, my students. But we are still far from the conclusion. But we are aiming to a deeper level of understanding of what is physics and what is mathematics. So that's what I call that exotic symmetry of space, exotic symmetries of space and time, symmetries that you are not accustomed to see. Now let's begin. What is a philosophical background? Well, Euclid gave the definition, and which I will repeat. A point, according to Euclid, is something which has no dimension, no height, no breadth, no length, and no width, no length, and therefore has no structure and has no symmetry. It's just the tiniest geometrical object possible, and I will discuss that later. But the moment, philosophical background. We have the Euclidean geometry, which is based on the axiomatic system. It's certainly the first axiomatic system in action in the world history. But it was followed over the century by Descartes, who developed the method of so-called coordinate method in geometry, or Cartesian geometry. But Descartes is also the author of a series of books called System of the World. So the ambition of Descartes was not only to be a geometer, a mathematician, but also a physicist and even a philosopher, I mean, philosophy of nature, natural philosophy. So Newton, well, we repeat that Newton came after that and identified the absolute space of physics with the Euclidean space of Euclidean geometry. Then Spinoza has played a very important role. Spinoza, there is a turning point in the thinking of Spinoza, and the turning point is a motto which is very often written in the work of Spinoza: Deus sive natura. Deus sive natura, which is an equation which was, I suppose, strange in the 18th century. God or, but sive is not exactly or, I mean, more or less equal nature. So that was the first time that we tried to, that was a very important step in the development of natural philosophy, that that comes also with the words of Pascal, who say there is a God of the philosophers and the mathematicians, and there is a God of the gospel, and they are not exactly the same. So for Pascal, and Pascal made a clear distinction between Pascal the physicist and the mathematician, and Pascal the believer. And that was a strong opposition in him. And in modern times, we have seen some similar personal experience with Grothendieck. I mean, Grothendieck, for him, there was a god of the Spinoza or Kantian god who is a ruler of nature, but an abstract ruler of nature and a personal god of the religions. And Grothendieck personal experience can not be understood if you don't take this into account, that he's not only the inventor of, the discoverer of many great steps in mathematics, but also his experience has been the experience of a believer, and, well, you can say an exotic experience of a believer. But you can consider Grothendieck as an exotic personality, but you cannot ignore this aspect. So Kant came just after Spinoza, and for Kant, thinks if geometry was such, it was because it was an a priori form of the reason. That has been very often argued, and I will not repeat. I'm not clearly the best person to discuss this. But in a sense, for me, the point was that what Kant aimed at was a philosophical justification of the Euclid-Newton space. The Euclidean space is the one where objects are sit, which is a kind stable space without motion, and the space of Newton is a space of motion. But the arena, main point is that the arena where the motion takes place is the space of Euclid. And so this combination of kinematic dynamics and stability or statics is embodied into the combination of Euclid and Newton. And what Kant wanted is to give an a priori axiomatic proof, starting from general principle of philosophy, that this was the only possibility. People at times during the history of science have tried to repeat this. And at the end of the 19th century, there were quite many efforts, let's say, by people like Ernst Mach or Helmholtz, or to some extent Poincaré, to prove that the geometry we know, the mechanics we know, is only possible. Unfortunately, just after that came the discovery of relativity by Einstein, and then the quantum mechanics of the atom, which destroyed all this hope. So again, so it's, I think it's, on the one hand, a very fruitful endeavor to try to understand the basic philosophical the philosophical background of our assumptions in mathematics or physics. At the same time, you have to be aware of a phenomenon which has been very often alluded recently in dynamics, the so-called, big change can occur from a small variation, and that in the axiomatic view of the world, if you have a set of assumptions which are all very natural from a philosophical or sometimes theological point of view, if you make sometimes a small change in the assumption, and you get a new system which looks as natural as the one, but the mathematical consequences are quite different. So one has to be very careful about that. So it's certainly a very important thing to do, but we have to wait for the confrontation with the outside world. So to finish, so that's, I'm trying to alter the various opinions or various views of space, what is space over the century. So two more steps before I come to my subject properly. There have been a non-Euclidean geometry revolution. And for our purpose, the main lesson to be drawn from non-Euclidean geometry is a growing divorce between the mathematical space and the physical space. Gauss, at the beginning of the 19th century, was still trying to confirm experimentally the law of geometry by measuring a big triangle, measuring accurately the three angles, and making the sum and adding them to make 180 degrees. And Gauss was well aware that the geometry on the surface of the Earth is not the geometry on a plane, because the Earth has some curvature. Nevertheless, he tried to see that, and we could repeat the same kind of experiment using laser beam between the Moon, Mars, and the Earth if you want to make a very big triangle and measure accurately. So, until the beginning of 19th century, the laws of geometry were natural laws. And that parallel axiom is true, was a natural fact, a fact of nature. And we had to prove it either by experiment or by convincing ourselves by rational arguments. And of course, the divorce, the possibility that a non-Euclidean geometry, where some aspect of the Euclidean geometry were denied, was quite a scandal until Riemann, through Riemann, and then we come to Poincaré and Einstein, that until that, far from being an exotic geometry, the non-Euclidean geometry was not an exotic geometry, it was a basis of the realistic geometry. But from that on, the distinction was very clear in the mind of everyone that you had two different levels. You have the rational geometry, which is an object of purely mathematical object, which can be decided by purely logical and mathematical means, and a physical space or physical geometry, which has to be decided according to measurement and experiment. Of course, that the two are just two sides of the same geometry is obvious, but that was a great, great breakthrough that you could divide the study of geometry into two parts, which are not completely independent, but which can be pursued more or less independently. So the modern period, it's not my purpose, and Roger Penrose was supposed to come here, and so he is one of the experts in general relativity, that means the Einstein theory of gravitation, and it's not my purpose to tell you about the method of Einstein to depict the world with four dimensions, so a pseudo-Riemannian geometry in four dimensions. Now, of course, there are discussions whether the true number of dimensions is four of 3 plus 1, or it's 11. Well, there's some suspicion that we have 10 or 11 dimensions, and that I will not discuss that. I mean, it's string theory which aims at understanding how we could have at the same time 10 dimensions and see only 4, but it's not my purpose. So I mean that I will speak of the physics taking place in an arena which is the classical arena of Newton as revised by Einstein. But at the fundamental level, the Minkowski view of the space, time, as a space with 4 dimensions and a quadratic form which is x squared plus y squared plus z squared, which is natural according to Pythagoras' theorem, minus the times to the square multiplied by c, the speed of light, to the square. So plus, minus, instead of plus. So, but from a philosophical point of view, there is not much difference. And the gravitation, so the physics I will consider, will ignore gravitation. So, of course, you all know that one of the aims of the string theory is to reconcile gravitation theory with the rest of physics, which is basically quantum physics. And tonight, I will not tell you anything about that. My purpose will be different. So the arena where physics takes place, with some qualification, is the natural space of Euclid, Newton, Kant, as slightly revised by Einstein and Minkowski. Now we come to the nature of points. And there are 3 subsections in my talk, which are called the nature of, the nature of, the nature of, and which remind me not so long ago I participated to a debate in the Vatican University about ontology in science. Penrose was there, and so maybe I was influenced by this. Remember, well, it's for dinner time I have many stories about the Vatican, but not in such a public talk. Okay, so the nature of points. As I said, points according to Euclid are naked. They have no dimension, and geometry evolved according to 3 dimensions, 3 axes, and to measure according to one of these 3 directions, a point has 0 dimension. So, but there is an important question to be raised. What are the basic constituents of geometrical object? And here, there is a change, there has been over the century, of change of perspective. For Euclid, points were only one limiting case of a geometrical construction. The object of geometry was to consider straight lines, circle, planes, conic surface, spheres, whatever. Now, you could consider a piece of a line, and well, even for Euclid, a line is not infinite line. It's just usually a segment between 2 points, joining 2 points. But there is an assumption that if you go in straight line from A to B, you can go forever. You can continue from B to C, from C to D, etc., without any natural boundary. But a line for Euclid is not an infinite one. I mean, you are used to say the straight line in coordinate is a set of points satisfying some equation, AX plus BY is C, but it's not so in Euclid. You have to put the natural border. So it's a line is a segment between 2 points. But you have circle, you have surfaces, you have its volume, and so on. And this can be combined in various ways, by intersection, by drawing, and so on. But the points are just one limiting, limiting constituent when everything collapses to zero dimension. Well, points in themselves came, the consideration of points in mathematics or physics came from 2 different sources. First of all, Leibniz, in his well-known book called Monadology, tried to base a philosophy of nature which was in opposition to the views of Descartes. For Descartes, the space was filled with tornadoes, tourbillon. And for Leibniz, was influenced by mostly by Democritus, or Democritus, better. The theory of atoms, the world was built out of monads. Monads means units, of course, monads. And one important statement in the monadology, the monads have no windows. They are like spaceships, totally shut to the outside world. You can imagine that each monad is a small spaceship flowing around in the free space. And they cannot communicate what is inside and then cannot learn what is outside. There are no windows. It's very important. So it means that for Leibniz, if the monads, which are more or less the smallest constituent, the monads have some inner structure, this inner structure can have no interaction with the outside world. So that remains their secret, but they cannot communicate that. What for Leibniz, and he based his dynamical views on that, the monads have no windows, they cannot communicate what is inside, but they can react to each other. Let's say, collide and react, or influence each other. So, it's a philosophy where the basic objects are points, but what is basic is a relation between points. And modern views of mathematics are strongly influenced by that. And in many textbooks of mathematics, you will read, a set is a collection of objects which have property and can have relation to each other. It's very much in the spirit of Leibniz. So, that's the view of Leibniz about points. There was another view by Democritus, which is an atom. Atom in the old sense of the Greek philosophy, which is the ultimate constituent of matter or nature, but again, it has no internal structure. Well, you had sometimes a thinker would explore the idea of atoms with gears or atoms with arms. I mean the atom crochet. I mean the atom crochet, as you said. Which means that these atoms, if they wanted to accumulate, they had to, I mean, like if you want to put a wall out of stones, I mean, you have to put, I mean, the stones cannot stay just one over the other one, the wall will fall, but you have to have some grips, means of gripping. So, but this doesn't distract you from the idea that the atoms were independent units, and very similar to what Leibniz, what happened inside is of no relevance. I don't say no of no importance, I say of no relevance. And the important thing is that they move freely in space, and when they come close to each other, something happens. Well, we are used to say that our views of atoms go back to the Greek, and especially to Democritus and other writers in the ancient ages. But modern atom has not much to do with these views. The modern atom is more like the Russian doll. When you open it, there is another doll. When you open it, there is another doll. You open it, there is another doll. And it's a hierarchical system. And what is explained in all the textbooks in modern physics is a hierarchical system with many layers. And I begin, let's say, for the chemist, the basic object is a molecule. But again, when you read in the old papers, let's say in the 19th century, molecule usually doesn't mean molecule in the chemical sense that we are used to. It means a tiny piece of matter. If you read, let's say, Lagrange in his analytical dynamics or other writers, even late in the 19th century, molecule means a tiny piece of matter. It doesn't mean that the author believes in the atomic system. And strangely enough, when I was a student in a big auditorium, even bigger like that, I attended at La Sorbonne. I was very afraid to attend the first lecture in the of the year in the course called General Physics, and that was in the fall 1590, and the professor started. What some people call atomic physics. And atomic hypothesis as normal 5 years after Hiroshima. Okay. I have to confess that I did not come the second time, but I had to make a compromise to get my degree anyhow. Okay, I finally found the right compromise to get my degree without attending the lecture. Well, I don't have to tell students about that. I mean, I'm an old professor and I don't have to give bad advice to the student. Okay, so, but the modern atom began with molecules, which is for the chemist. Well, go to the biochemist and he will tell you how many molecules of such a kind you have in your blood. And then molecules are made of atoms, you all know that. Atoms, after Arago, are made of a nucleus with a cloud of electrons. But the nucleus itself is not is a compound object, is made of protons and neutrons, but it's not the end of the Darshan doll, and the modern thing is the quarks. Every proton or neutron is made of three quarks. And we hope that at the moment, what we call the standard model of particles and fields is at the end, and that we have reached the ultimate level with quarks and leptons and the gluons and other fields, which are just using, as I said, that this atom needs grips to come in contact with it. And in the modern view, we have the so-called, we have the fermion, quark and leptons, and we have the boson, which connects them. Okay, etc. And now, I come back to that later, the basic idea is a gauge field, and gauge field is a field with symmetry, that's the point. So far, I've explained the views about the nature of point evolving over the centuries, and we have seen that they basically a point, well, a point or atom, you can debate whether it's the same object. It is and it is not. For the mathematician, but what we have in the modern views of mathematics, and I come to the notion of set, or to the ontology of set, to please my Vatican host. And so, according to the modern views, a space is a collection of points. Well, in the modern view, every mathematical object is a set. And a set is in itself a collection of objects. Well, the objects of the set are again collection of objects, and there is so a hierarchy. And quite often, one can depict, and that was done with great force by Gödel in his 1939 paper about the non-contradiction of the axiom, continuous hypothesis in the axiom of choice. It depicts the set as a hierarchy. And the point is that if you go to the so-called minimal model or natural model, whatever, the minimal model of Gödel, you see that everything is built out of nothing. The only set which exists in the beginning is the empty set, the set which has no member. And it's just by fiat that you declare a collection with nothing in it is a collection. Well, you give a name or you use a symbol, the O with a bar, the stroke. Okay, then basically, you have a certain explicit collection of operation of sets. Well, we are all familiar with that. If you have two sets, you can join them by union, or take the common part, which is intersection. Well, you can take the difference, which are the Boolean operations. But there is more. If you have a set, the collection of all subsets of this set is a new collection. You have the set of all natural numbers, and a collection of natural numbers is a new object. Right. So, and the point is that starting from the really nothing, the empty set, which has nothing in it, you create a whole stratification of set. The trick is that if you have any object, there is a set which contains only this as an element, well, x between braces in the standard notation, but which has not to be confused. And I suppose it's Frege who was the first time distinguished between an object and the set, a collection consisting of this empty. Well, we call it a singleton now. It was a very ingenious logical trick. And out of that, you can build. Now, there is one reservation about this. which is a question of ontology. If you believe strictly in the standard definition of sets, a set is a collection. But before you can declare that the set exists, the collection has to exist, which means that the existence of the set presupposes the existence of all the constituents. When you say, let's say, the set of men, well, you, men or women, let's say human beings, the set of human beings, the humanity, you preempt the fact that you have a complete control of all human beings. So humanity cannot exist logically, philosophically, without having first checked that all the human beings are there, that you have a complete grip about them, that no one is missing and no one is sneaking into the room after that, and etc. And what is worse is with a set of subsets. If you have, let's say, for instance, according to the axiom of set of subsets, you can speak of an arbitrary sequence of 0 and 1. And when it comes to speak of what is a real number, you say it's something which can be written in, let's say, in a binary way as, let's say, a number between 0 and 1. You take the decimal point, and then you begin 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, etc., etc., and you continue forever. And what it means, and really when everyone was thought about that, what it really means, an arbitrary sequence of 0 and 1. That means something which can be generated at first without giving a rule. Which if I say, well, you do 1, 1, okay, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, etc., that gives a very precise rule. But if you give the sequence with rule, and it's one classical dilemma in set theory, if you define the sequence of 0 and 1 which obey some rule, you can only have a countable number of them, and we all know through the diagonal argument that the set of real numbers is uncountable. So it's really difficult to bypass this difficulty. Well, if you are pragmatical, you say the set are governed by a certain system of rules and it's safe. On the other hand, there have been some system which was more or less viewed as an alternative to set theory is what Bertrand Russell named type theory. And I'm more convinced, well, despite a certain number of technical flaws. I mean, there are technical flaws in the theory of types by Bertrand Russell, and they are well known, they have been heavily discussed, and I will not come back to that discussion. But to me, it's more, I think it makes more sense. So, for instance, I don't know whether set theory as we know it will survive. I mean, with a credo that a set is a collection of objects which you have to preempt. But if you teach, let's say, calculus in a university course, you begin by speaking about numbers. Then at some point you introduce functions, whether they are rational functions, polynomials, or elementary functions. But you introduce the idea of a function. A function operates on numbers, and a function is a rule which out of a number produces another rule. If I tell you what is a function sine, it just say I give you x is, in some units, let's say 30, so if you take degree, of, and then it gives out of 30, which is out input, it produces an output. And now with modern technology, you buy a small pocket computer, you press a key 30, you press a key sine, and it produces the answer. Okay, so that's now the next step is function. But when you go to higher classes in analysis, you will learn about Hilbert spaces, Banach spaces, and so on, operators, which means that the functions themselves are not considered isolated, but as a member of big families, which have certain properties in common, and then you can operate on functions. And the first instance is when the derivation operation. If you take a function in one variable, which satisfies certain smoothness condition, you can speak of the derivative. So the derivative is really a function acting on function. And since I'm in Great Britain, I'm very happy to to remind you that the great creator of this was George Boole. George Boole is mostly known for his contribution to logic. I mean, but read his two books about differential equations and about the calculus of difference, and you will see that there is much more in George Boole than what is taught usually in the introductory course in logic. Okay, so, but these distinctions, well, that you have this hierarchy of numbers, and then a function active of number, and then a spaces of functions, and then operators, and so on, I think this will remain. Whatever our opinion about the ontology of set, this will remain. And the clear distinction of, and this is a type theory, and this has some relevance for modern computer science, because most of the modern computer systems are type systems. Not all of them, but most of them are typed. And when you write x, you have to make a declaration, real x, or integer x, or boolean x, or whatever. And I think, or operator, and there are various systems, computer science systems, and you have to take this into account. So this is about the nature of sets. So nature of points, nature of sets, and now I come before going to what is really crucial, the notion of symmetry. I come to the nature of numbers. What is a number? Mm-hmm. Not so easy at all, also. Modern view is, according to Dedekind, to Cantor, that, well, there are variations in the exposition, but basically, a number is given when you give the sequence of its digits in a binary or decimal expansion. And as I said, the twist is that you say any sequence, let's say, of 0 and 1 is a binary expansion of some number. But as I discussed already, the meaning of an arbitrary is not so clear. But now, if you go back to the history, and that will tell us something, and then I can explain the modern views later on. And in the classical geometry of Euclid, there is a book, which is the sixth book, which is basically the geometric algebra. It's algebra was not known to Euclid, but there is a substitute. There's a substitute in certain geometrical constructions. And for instance, we begin by the theory of planes or plane areas. So we learn to calculate the area of a triangle, of a rectangle, or other trapezoid, and so on. And also the circle. So we have to make a strong distinction between the polygonal area, which are delineated by straight lines or segments, and the curved curve. And so, but what you learn, and that can be taught to to students of the age of 10 or 11, and with scissors and glues, how you cut a triangle into two pieces, you reassemble, and so on. And there are many proofs. The best one is by Legendre of the theorem of Pythagoras by, well, sum of two squares is another square, and you take it seriously. That means you draw two squares, a square plus b square is really geometrical square, and you cut them and reassemble them to make another square, which is exactly the meaning of Pythagoras. Well, the proof by Euclid is similar but much more complicated. The one by Legendre is very easy, and interestingly enough, if you look at the various traditions, Indian or Chinese, and now of course it's better documented in modern history. And we are better aware of what has been done by the Chinese and the Indians, and you find variants of this. Well, by the way, of course, the so-called, the Pascal triangle is already printed explicitly in some book in the 10th century in China. people were rather happy with that. And of course, our standard terminology of square has a geometrical meaning, obviously. A square of a number is a geometrical meaning. The circle made a difficulty, and squaring the circle has been an ambition for many centuries. And we all know now that it cannot be achieved by a finite amount of construction. But when we go to higher dimensions, there is a puzzle. We learn that when you have a pyramid, let's say with a triangle which is a square or triangle, if you want to compute the volume of the pyramid, you have to multiply the area of the base by one-third of the 8. One-third. Why one-third? And one-third, in modern terms, because if you integrate x squared dx between 0 and 1, you get one-third. And that gives a key to higher understanding. But prior to that, one-third, usually one-third, it would mean what? If the volume of something is one-third of a certain product, well, the product can be seen easily as the volume of a prism. I mean, so it can say, you can say that the volume of a certain pyramid is one-third of the volume of a certain prism. The natural question is, how do you prove that? So instead of dividing, you multiply. You say if I three times the volume of a certain pyramid is the volume of a certain prism. How do you prove that? By puzzle. You cut, you reassemble, and so on. But that doesn't work. And that was one of the questions. That was one of the questions of Hilbert in his series of problems in the Paris meeting at the beginning of the 20th century. You can, third problem, can you prove this statement by elementary geometry? That means cutting and reassociating. And the answer is no. That means you really need calculus at this point. So the great discovery is that, well, calculus was invented more or less by Archimedes, to catch the surface, the length of a circle, the surface of a sphere, the volume of a sphere, which were not polyhedra or polygons. And it was supposed, of course, we knew that there was one step, and that pi, the number of pi, 314, etc., was something new that you could not ignore. But it happens that already one-third may have a hidden meaning, as an integral. That means integral, it means that certain infinite process has to be performed. So now about the nature of pi. We all know that pi, after many centuries, has been declared first of all, an irrational number that was known at the end of 18th century, maybe even a little before. That pi squared is an irrational number was a little more difficult, proved by Lambert, a clerk and a high school teacher, elementary school teacher in Alsace at the end of 18th century. But pi was declared transcendental only at the end of 19th century, and that was a great achievement. But what does it mean that pi is transcendental in terms of symmetry? It means that pi, you cannot have a relation like pi squared plus 2 plus 3 pi is 0 or something like that. You cannot have an equation, and that it's an equation with a rational coefficient, an integral coefficient, which is valid, and which means that if you had such an equation, you could replace pi by any other object. And it's a beginning of the ambiguity, and I come to that, which will be the last item in my description of exotic symmetry. Ambiguity. What is ambiguity? Well, ambiguity has been devised by Galois himself, and in his last letter, the letter he wrote just before he died, he says that his theory, the Galois theory of algebraic equation, is just the beginning of a vast theory of ambiguity. And what does it mean, ambiguity? Well, ambiguity has to refer, and I come really to the core of the point, symmetry. Okay, there are various kinds of symmetries, and they usually come in pairs. For instance, you have passive and active symmetry. By passive symmetry, I mean that you have, let's say, my two hands. They form a symmetry which is passive, which means the following, that I show you my two hands, they don't move, they stay fixed, and I compare. Okay, I have one, nail here, one nail here, which are the same shape. There is one line and one line which have the same shape and so on. And I compare the different parts of my left hand and my right hand. Well, you all know that left hand and right hand is not exactly the same, but for the purpose of the demonstration, ignore this. So I have five fingers here, I have five fingers here, there's one short finger and one long, four long finger and so on, and then two sides. So you study carefully my left hand, you study carefully my right hand, you try to depict it by words, and suppose you want to communicate, well, that has been often stated. So once you want to communicate by your radio system, by your communication system to someone who is very far away, you want to describe your left hand. And, well, my left hand has five fingers and your right hand, five fingers. But how do you distinguish left and right? Well, and yes, Wittgenstein has been very fond of that distinction, monstration, he said. Well, I cannot tell you the difference between left and right hand unless I show you this is my right hand, this is my left hand. That means no objective quality can distinguish my left hand. I call that a passive symmetry, which means that I have two objects and I compare them. Now, what is an active symmetry? An active symmetry is using motion. An active symmetry, your motion, either progressive motion or instantaneous motion. So I take this left hand and I bring it here. So, because I can follow here, it's the same object, or I can use a mirror. But it's an active symmetry in the sense that some construction has to be performed. Instead of just looking at the various capacities and various properties of my two hands, I do some construction. Well, the same, there are also similar examples which are symmetries of objects and symmetries of laws. Symmetry of object, I've given some example, my two hands, but symmetries of law. If you want to go higher into the understanding of symmetry, you should say, why is my left hand so similar to my right hand? Almost exactly similar. Except for orientation, which is another puzzle. But because if we use our knowledge of embryology, at some point, my body was developing in the first stages of, before my birth, in the first stages, I had no hands, and then a certain, we don't give you a lecture in embryology, I would not be able, but you all know the basic things, and that at some point, the two hands, and that the body show a spinal cord, and that the left side and the right side develops very symmetrically. Why do they develop symmetrically? Because the organic law, the biological law which govern the development of the left part are exactly the same as the one governing the right part. So it's another explanation for symmetry, that two objects are symmetrical, are more or less the same, because in their construction or in their development, you have followed the same steps. And if the steps at each level, at each stage of the development, when we take one step on the left and one step of the right, they are exactly the same, then the final result will be the same. Okay, but now Galois symmetry. Galois symmetry, it's a strange thing. It's a strange thing. It compares symmetries of equations and symmetry of roots. Symmetry of equation and symmetry of roots. Let's see. I take a very simple example. From elementary algebra, I will do the following calculation. I take the square root of 3 plus 1, raise it to a square. The result, if you don't remember, do it in your head, it's 4 plus 2 times the square root of 3. Okay, but every student know or should know that once you have done the calculation of square root of 3 plus 1 is blah, 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 if he replaces square root of 3 by minus square root of 3, so minus square root of 3 plus 1 square, etc., he can guess the result without doing again the calculation. Everywhere in the calculation, it systematically replaces square root of 3 by minus square root of 3. And you don't have to repeat all the steps. If he replaces square root of 3 by minus square root of 3 in the initial formula, then he will have it at the end. What does it mean? It means that square root of 3 is not a well-defined object. The only thing we know about square root of 3, according to its definition, is that it's something whose square is 3. X square is 3. So all you are allowed to do, the only thing you are allowed to do is the following. You introduce a certain symbol, X. You can replace X by anything you want. Square root of 3 in the standard writing. It doesn't matter. You treat it as a black box. And then square root X equals 3. And then you do calculation with X. And every time you meet X square, you can simplify and replace X square by 3. And of course, if you do that calculation, you all know that there are two numbers plus square root of 3, the positive one and the negative one, which satisfy the same equation X of 3. But because everything you have done is not dealing with a number properly, but dealing with the equation which is satisfied by the number, then all the calculation proof are the same. That means there is an ambiguity. You can replace square root of 3 by minus square root of 3. It's ambiguous. You cannot distinguish from the definition. You cannot distinguish. In order to distinguish square root of 3 from minus square root of 3, you have to add some external observation, some external information, like distinguishing my left hand and my right hand. Okay. And you can continue to that. And, well, square root of minus 1 plus or minus square root of minus 1 is even more puzzling, and I will not repeat. And my friend Pierre Deligne, when he begins a paper, mathematical paper, he say, I'm introducing the symbol I, which means one of the square root of minus 1. I don't decide which one. And everything should be consistent if I replace one of the square root of minus 1. Okay. Well, it's the same as geometrically orienting the complex plane, etc. So, we have here something which was very important, a very important discovery of Galois, that on the one hand you have symmetry of the equation. Let's say, suppose that your equation represents a certain straight line or certain circle geometrically. Now, perform a geometrical transformation on the line on the circle. Of course, a new line or a new circle, we have a new equation. And you have well-established rule in element in coordinate geometry. If you know the equation of a certain object, a certain line surface, and if you perform a geometrical transformation, you know how to derive the equation of the new object, the transform object. So that's symmetry of equations. That means the equation describing object. But these equations are solutions. That means a geometrical object consists of points. And now there are subtle distinctions which may enable you to replace in some part of the calculation some solution by some other. Suppose we have a complicated geometrical construction and square root of 3 is needed. Okay. Of course, square root of 3, you distinguish it from minus square root of 3 because you declare square root of 3 has to be positive, which is a new thing, a new relation that you declare. But, well, I will not teach you a course, let's say, in real algebraic geometry, but it has been the question of what it means to be positive, that it is a square or a sum of square, is well understood now. But the point is that you have to make some declaration at some point. If you want to deal with the square root of 3 only, without any other mathematical object, let's say ordinary integral numbers or rational numbers, and you add square root of 3. All the way along, you cannot distinguish between square root of 3 and minus square root, like the left and right hand. But, of course, at some point you declare that you have, among the numbers, you have some that you qualify as positive number, but you have to make a decision, a declaration. So, now, if I use a symbol square root of 3, it means that this object not only satisfies the fact that the square is 3, but also that it is positive. That means that it can be used in certain inequality and to deal with inequality according to established rule. So, now this is the ambiguity. Now I come to the what it means for physics. What it means for physics? Well, on the one hand, Grothendieck has developed a theory of categories, sheaves, site, topo, etc., where the notion, and with a very sophisticated notion of a point. And if you are interested in the technicalities, I refer you to my paper in the Baltic American Mathematical Society. But these points are highly sophisticated. They are called fiber functors or point functors. But the point is that the important feature is that these points have embedded symmetries. I mean, by their nature, they have symmetries. Okay, so so the symmetry of a point are something well established. And when I spoke about replacing square root of 3 by minus square root of 3, it means that, well, in sophisticated terms, I have the field Q with square root of 3 added, the rational number of squares of root of 3 added. It's a field, and this you take the spectrum of a field, and the spectrum of a field is a good example of a point in geometry. Spectrum of a field in geometry. But a point has no symmetry, but a field has symmetries. And in my example, if I take Q of square root of 3, which means a collection of all numbers of the form A plus B square root of 3, I can everywhere replace square root of 3 by minus square root of 3. And this transformation is transparent to the geometrical construction, which means in practical terms that you have two groups of symmetry which commute to each other. The Galois group of symmetry, which is an inner group, which really acts on the point, or what takes place of the point in algebraic geometry, and the group of transformation, let's say moving a line, taking a symmetry with respect to a plane, and so on. These two kinds of symmetry commute to each other. So they are as alien as possible to each other. Okay. So, but then out of that, Groot and Dick introduce the next step was the idea, and it's very fashionable in these days, the idea of a motif. A motif, interestingly enough, the motif were at least partly inspired by the deep religious conviction of Grothendieck. And Grothendieck took his inspiration, despite his Jewish ancestors, and his grandfather was a Hasidim priest. Hasidim is the most serious Jews, were the most serious Jews in Ukraine. But despite that, his ancestor and his grandfather, as I said, was a Hasidim rabbi. Then he takes his inspiration from the Buddhists. And one of the basic ideas of Buddhists is transmigration of souls. And for Grothendieck, one explanation for the mathematical notion of motifs is that you take a body, let's say a geometrical space. It's made of parts. Now you cut the part, you disassemble it. You take a part of the body. And then this part of the body transmigrate to another place and reassemble as a part of another body. So it's the idea of the geometrical space. It would take some time to explain it in technical terms. But the idea, and I would say that for the knowledgeable people, the spaces have cohomological invariance, but of various kinds. They are zero cohomology, one cohomology, and so on. And basically, the motif is a part of the space which carries only part of the cohomology. That's basically the basic idea and the basic understanding. So the deepest geometrical characters of the space are embodied in this cohomology, and you can disassemble this cohomology according to the various degrees and move one part to the other one. So I will not speak. It would take, many hours of lecturing about what is a pure motif, a Chow motif, a pure Tate motif, a mixed Tate motif. I've taught that course during the past month more than once, and I will not repeat it today. It's not my purpose. But this is the idea. But the idea is that this motif carries an own symmetry. When you take a piece of the space and transfer it to one piece, another place, inside this piece there is some hidden symmetry, and it's transposed. And this hidden symmetry is expressed as the action of a certain group, which is very akin, the Galois group, and that Grothendieck calls a motivic Galois group. Well, you can understand. I gave you some flavor of the Galois group just for the non-expert. Well, I mean, I suppose many people have followed courses in algebra and know much more about Galois group. I just wanted to give the spirit. And explain why Galois himself called it a theory of ambiguity. And then, but then Galois Furia gave you some flavor and motive. I just gave you a very faint account of them. And so motive Galois group means a group of operation on the motive. And the motive are like the atom in chemistry. I mean, a molecule is made, water is made, H2O. I've seen a sign somewhere outside this building, H2O. So H twice H and one O. And these are the basic atoms, and you can cut the molecule of water and then reassemble the oxygen and hydrogen in other ways to do biochemistry, for instance, organic chemistry. And but each piece, each atom of oxygen of hydrogen has its own symmetry and keeps it. So this picture, I think, is a good mental picture of what it is. So the idea is that they play more or less the role of atoms, the motive plays the role of atom, or points, if you want, or parts of points. It's much more subtle, a part of a point, if I can speak of that. So, and keeping the symmetry when they transmigrate in other places, it keeps the symmetry. Now, what do we have similar in physics? And I will finish with a similar description of the so-called standard model in physics. I gave already some hints about that. This hierarchy of elementary particles, well, the molecule, the atom, the nucleus made of nucleons, which are protons and neutrons, and the proton and neutrons are made of quarks, etc. And so there is this hierarchy. Now the point is that this hierarchy is organized according to some symmetry principle. The basic starting point was the idea of the isotopic spin, which was invented by Heisenberg in the 40s, which means that, again, ambiguity. It's very difficult to distinguish a proton from a neutron. Well, there is one way to distinguish. One has an electric charge, and the other one, which is the proton, and the neutron has not. Neutron is neutral electrically. But if you consider, if you disregard electric forces, which at the nucleus level are very weak, when you do atomic energy, of course, it's the electromagnetic force which are dominant. When you do nuclear energy, it's the nuclear forces. And if the nuclear energy is so powerful, it's just because the energy which take place in the nucleus are much, much stronger, much more important than the one which takes place in chemistry. Okay, so they are strong forces, and they have this nuclei. But then they are symmetry, which means that you cannot distinguish, if you disregard electric forces, which are quite weak at this level, the proton and the neutron are ambiguously indistinguishable. They cannot be distinguished. And the idea is to put them as two members of some ideal space. So it's a space with two coordinates, so neutron there, proton there. And then this space has two dimensions, so it has a geometry, it has symmetries. And this is exactly the so-called, isotopic spin group. So, again, it's a hidden symmetry. You cannot see it. It doesn't really exist at the visible level, because it just depends on the fact, which is a basic principle of, it's a Schrödinger cat, who doesn't know. Well, I don't like really very much this picture, but of course it's easier to use it. The Schrödinger cat is half dead, half living, and in the isotopic symmetry, the neutron is half neutron, half proton, some ambiguity. Okay, and then, but then when you want to explore to in depth this system, you have to introduce so-called gauge group. This symmetry with two dimensions has to be enlarged to complicated way. And now, recently, Alain Cohn has proposed a view of the universe which can be... Okay. A view of the universe which is as follows. The universe, our geometrical space, is organized at... There are three levels of understanding. The most elementary, which is the arena, which I mentioned, Euclid, Einstein plus Minkowski. It's a flat space of in this regard gravitation. It's a flat space in four dimensions with a very simple geometry, which is akin to the Euclidean geometry. You replace sphere by hyperboloid, but it's all the same. So that's where phenomena take place. But now, when you look at an elementary particle, in this space, an elementary particle is one point. But there is another dimension. There is an extra dimension, which is the inner structure of this point, this elementary particle. And this inner structure has a certain symmetry, and it's known as gauge theory. And but according to the picture of Kohn, it should be considered as a space with finitely many possibilities. It's a complicated space because it's a fuzzy space. It has finitely many points. By this point, can mix into each other, which is superposition principle in quantum physics, which is hard to explain in a few words. But basically, you have another dimension in space, which is that you have finitely many possibilities, but they can mix up. So really what you have a new picture of a space with finitely many points, with a huge symmetry, complicated symmetry, using a mixing principle. But there is one third possibility, which has been only very recently uncovered by Alain Kohn and his collaborators, mostly Mathilde Marcoli and Katia Consani. And then it's to take account of what physicists call dimensional regularization, which is a trick, a very mathematical trick, pretending that we are not working in four dimensions, but let's say in 3.99 dimensions. The difficulty is that in four dimensions, you have a lot of mathematical divergences. You write a certain integral, the result is infinite. That's infinity, that doesn't work. But if you could imagine a space with slightly less, 1% less dimension than four, then there are mathematical tricks to deal with that, and somehow this is well established now. You don't have to invent a complicated geometry, but there are, in some integrals you have a parameter and you change a parameter. If there was just 1% less, 1,000 less, everything would be perfect. So you pretend to work in a space of 4 minus a tiny dimension. Then, according to Kohn, you have to imagine that this 4 minus epsilon dimension, this epsilon runs independently of the rest. And now you have a three-level picture. The geometrical space-time, the gauge group, and then the dimension for renormalization. And they all come together. But then the last item has its own symmetry. This symmetry was known to the physicists as renormalization, but they consider it as a one-parameter group, which is quite poor in terms of mathematics and geometry. But what Alain Kohn has discovered is a huge infinite-dimensional group which lurks behind that. And this huge infinite-dimensional group is, called Kramer because of its discoverer, but the striking fact, which is only partly understood, is that this group is completely isomorphic to the so-called motivic Galois group. So here is a challenge. Grothendieck, on one hand, invented out of his geometric considerations, out of his purely mathematical insight, invented a huge group of symmetry, which had no counterpart before, and which is now very much studied by many, many people, but which had no ancestor. It was, I think, something delivered from nowhere. On the other hand, in physics, we had a similar symmetry group, a huge symmetry group, much larger than anything existing, because the Grothendieck group and the Kohn-Kramer group are infinite dimensional groups, quite huge group. And they come in parallel, and what we have is that they are isomorphic, abstractly isomorphic. That means, you can put them in one-to-one correspondence. They are isomorphic in the technical sense of group theory. But on the other hand, we have not yet been able to understand why. And one of the greatest challenges for the next 10 or 15 years is to understand that. And what can may come out is a better understanding of the nature of numbers. And I finish by this advertisement. 25 years ago, Roger Apéry was a quite unorthodox mathematician, made great noise by giving a sketch of a proof of something which has defied the best mathematician for at least one century, zeta of c, which is by definition the sum of the inverse of the cube, 1 over 1 plus 1 over 8 plus 1 over 27, etc., which is a certain number. This number is not rational. It cannot be expressed as a over b with a numerator and a denominator. That was a sudden, well, totally unexpected. What was totally unexpected is that someone could prove that, and also that Roger Apéry was not considered as considered as a freak, could do the proof. Well, to be honest, he did not give the proof. He gave the hint, but enough hints so that 2 months later, I mean, serious, to be called serious mathematician, Enrico and Don Zagier produced a formal proof out. But they were honest and they say it's Apéry's proof with all the detail provided. Okay, but this is an isolated result. For 25 centuries, the best expert in transcendental numbers have tried to go from zeta of 3 to zeta of 5, which is one sum of 1 over n to the 5. No one has been able to give any result into that direction. No, not a single result. And now, my hope, and that's the third aspect of this puzzle. So on the one end, we have the motif of Grothendieck. On the other end, you have the Kronheimer group. And as a bonus, if we can really understand the connection between the two, we will have a proof that zeta 5, zeta 7, and so on are irrational numbers, and much more. I mean, there are extended conjectures in transcendental numbers which are out of grip at the moment, but we are a certain number of people are convinced that if we better understand the challenge of comparing Grothendieck and Kron group, we will have the key to prove this purely number theoretical results. So it's again the music of the spheres. Thank you very much.
We've run rather late.
It took longer than 1 hour as expected.
We could afford time for one or two questions if anyone has some. And while you're thinking about it, perhaps I could take the chairman's privilege of asking two very short ones.
Yes.
Firstly, what you seem to be saying towards the end was that the exotic symmetries of space and time are really the symmetries of perhaps the standard model. You take the standard model, there are symmetry groups and so on. And what you're saying is those are groups, symmetry groups of the underlying space. That's why they are in the standard model. Am I doing you an injustice?
Well, the gauge group have been very much studied and understood, I think. So I should not put too much. Well, it's interesting, but you still have to learn many things. But the new development is about something which was rather unexpected, which is rather orthogonal to that, rather orthogonal. And I said exotic symmetry because it has no obvious geometrical explanation. That's why. I mean, the symmetry of the space-time, of course, have an obvious geometrical description. By nature, they are geometrical. The gauge symmetry, where, I mean, the mixing, let's say, the isotopic spin group, the mixing of the neutron and the proton, at first were rather mysterious. But over the years, geometry came to an help, came to help that, and what came out is a geometrical picture underlying this rather exotic. So now in a sense, they were exotic 40 years ago, but they are no more exotic because they have been well understood. Mm. And we have been able to develop a certain kind of geometry of the gauge group, which, I mean, I mentioned Chern because it's Chern and Chen Yin Yang who made a connection between the purely geometrical work of Chern and the physical work of Yang. And I remind you that the father of Yang was the teacher of Chern in a small town of South China long, long ago in the beginning of 20th century. But I would not consider these a puzzle now. I mean, they were puzzles 40 years ago, but they have been tamed. But the new challenge is that every time we seem to tame, to give a geometric closing to some symmetry, then a new symmetry emerges. And the exotic symmetry, I mean, what I call the exotic is that the new exotic, I would say the new exotic, the one which have not been completely understood now, which still have a challenge, and I could add exotic symmetry of space, time, and numbers. And that was the meaning of my last comment. I mean, the key to some deep problem in number theory, in arithmetics, lie in a better understanding of these things. And there are many reasons for that, but there are at least, more than one field middles for that. And I will make a confession. I mean, some years ago, I say my research program extends over the next 40 years, maybe a little too old for that. And I've been revising constantly. I say 20, then now 10. and I hope that my graduate student and my doctoral student at the moment will be able to give something interesting to that, maybe the final solution, at least some important steps. So I'm quite optimistic, and I say that within 10 years of hard work, about 10 years of hard work or 15 years to really uncover the meaning of these new symmetries. But there's much work to be done, but it's a future which is not too distant. I would not say anything about the Riemann hypothesis. It may be connected, maybe, but of course, yes. Like most mathematicians, at some point I try to do something in the direction of Riemann hypothesis. I publish even a paper which is entitled "How the Riemann Hypothesis Wasn't Proved," which records some of my numerical experience with that. How it wasn't proved, I will not make any prediction about the Riemann hypothesis. But about the major conjecture in transcendental numbers, I suppose that within 10 or 15 years, we can manage them.
Thank you.
Using hints from physics. That's the point. Using hints from physics.
Is there any question from the audience? Have a microphone. It's coming.
I was slightly surprised that you didn't mention any of the contributions of Li, or more particularly Elie Cartan, to the understanding
yes.
of symmetry.
Yes.
Your description of ambiguity was almost, well, it could have been a précis of the equivalence method ending up with
yes.
the ambiguity.
Yes.
So could you say something about how you think that might fit in?
Well, if I did not speak of Li and Carton, it's because I spoke at length about them a few days ago at the occasion of the birthday of André Weil. André Weil had been a follower and an admirer of Elie Carton and a friend of his son. And he said very often that one of the main purposes of Bourbaki was to preserve and give strong foundation to the work of Elie Cartan, one of the motivations. And he says that to me often. And so I will certainly not despise Lee and Cartan. Yes, you are right. I mean, the equivalence method of Cartan is very much in that. Maybe I can explain why. I think when Lee started his theory of Li groups, what you call Li groups now, he was basically interested in differential equations. That's true. He wanted to use a method of group theory to do with differential equations. And he had in time to create a differential Galois theory. But we know that differential Galois theory had to wait the work of Picard and Vesio and Kolchin. And I would say it's very surprising that the differential Galois theory came to fruition only very recently, despite a great book of the foundational papers of Picard and Vesio and the great book of Kolchin, that remained a rather isolated part of mathematics until quite recently. I did not speak about differential Galois theory, but in the method we use for motives or for mathematical physics, we use extensively the ideas, maybe not the method, but the ideas of differential Galois theory. And one of the ideas is that you deal in differential Galois theory, you deal in an algebraic way with solution of differential equation. I said you don't have to know what is square root of 3. All you have to know is that it's a certain symbol x whose square is 3, and you calculate according to this rule. And again, when you have a system of differential equation, you can consider formal solutions. That means formal solutions which have satisfy a certain rule, which is called the Picard-Vesio extension. But the main recent development is that the Picard-Vesio extension has been given a much more geometrical flavor. First by Ramis in Strasbourg, Strasbourg and then in Toulouse. So, but now the next development has been that the differential Galois theory has been given a much more flavor. But about Lie, that was in intention of Lie to create this differential Galois theory, but he misunderstood exactly the point I was insisting on. He thought that he had to study the symmetries of the equations. And if you think about, what is usually stated in courses, if you have a differential equation, if you have a group of transformation of your equation, the larger the group, the better it is, because you can reduce the equation to something simpler. And ideally, if you have enough symmetry on the differential equation, you can solve it. But Galois theory is exactly the opposite. The larger the group of symmetries, the easier it is to solve the equation. But in Galois theory, if the group of the Galois group, that means the group of ambiguity among the roots, is large, you cannot just specify the roots. I mean, if you cannot distinguish between square root of 3 and minus square root of 3, in order to do that, you have by some trick to reduce the Galois group to nothing. So an equation is solved by Galois theory when you have been able by suitable construction to reduce the initial Galois group to a group with one element. In Lie theory, in order to solve, you need to need a large group of symmetry of the equation. But I said the Galois group and the group of symmetry of the equation commute to each other. When you have two groups which commute to each other element-wise, if one is large, the other one is small. And that explains. And I think that was on purpose that I did not mention Lie for that. I mean, symmetries, of course, symmetries. Published work, was called Seminars of Fuseli. Well, it's only a Samizdat publication in the West, and it's a serious book in Russia. All my Russian friends told me that they learned the theory from my notes. And that was called Seminars of Fuseli. So the work of Lie is immense. But in that purpose, it was a little confusing. We all know that in science, confusion can be something good. That means someone starts with a certain program, is not able to carry his program, but he carries another program, which is as interesting as possibly interesting. So that's it. And about Cartan, I'm just writing some historical account of some development in geometry, and I came recently through the paper of Cartan. I've been really amazed. I mean, especially a series of papers about the Riemannian symmetric spaces. That's really amazing. So, I would say that, of course, Cartan and Lie are really important figures in this theory, but Lay is a little. I mean, there was some misunderstanding in the paper in the work of Lay, and that did that. I think that has. I think it's partly responsible for the fact that differential Galois theory evolved rather slowly. And on the other hand, Elie Carton, of course. I mean, I have to confess that I should have spoken more about him. And of course, but I said that I did not want to speak about general relativity and things like that. I wanted to speak about really quantum mechanics and what comes out of quantum mechanics in terms of symmetry. And it's at the moment, the development in quantum theory and the development in general relativity are more or less orthogonal to each other. Many people try to fill the gap between the two, to fill the chasm, but it's still done. It's not done. And but then, of course, the importance of Elie Carton has been stronger in the direction of general relativity, and we have this beautiful exchange of letters between Carton and Einstein, which was published by our Belgium colleagues from Belgium, and which is really a beautiful book. And Elie Carton acknowledged very often that he took a boost from the discovery of the general relativity and also from the work of Hermann Weyl. But Hermann Weyl was also very much influenced, and well, not only influenced by general relativity, played a very important role. And if there was one mathematician which played a role in all the developments of modern physics, I mean the two pillars, I mean general relativity and quantum mechanics, it's Hermann Weyl. And of course, Hermann Weyl should be mentioned. I mean, if you make a history of the notion of symmetry in physics and in mathematics, Hermann Weyl should be there. But I did not want to tell the whole story about symmetry. I wanted to speak about the exotic symmetries. And I suppose Hermann Weyl would be utterly pleased by this new development. I mean, utterly pleased. I did not have the chance to meet him personally. I mean, he died just a year too early, and Einstein and Hermann Weyl died the same year, if I'm correct. 1955, and was too young by a couple of years to meet both of these gods, mathematical gods, and this is one of my regrets. As a confession, I had a heart, and I carried for many years so-called Einstein heart. An old friend of Einstein in Princeton, I mean, was knitting a winter hat for Einstein, and when Einstein died, she had a couple left, and she made a friendship with my wife, and she handed one of these caps as a gift to my wife, and I carried a Einstein hat in the winter for a certain number of winters. But this is Einstein. Of course, there are many, much more. A complete history of idea of symmetry should be one. In 1 hour or 1.5 hour, I could not cover all these things. And I wanted to concentrate on the new aspect, of course. I did not want to tell again a beautiful story, but this story has been told often by many good people. And of course, if you want to have one example of a mathematician who could understand physics, it's Hermann Weyl, really Hermann Weyl. No one can be compared to him. And it's surprising that when André Weil and Chevalier wrote an obituary to Hermann Weyl, they praise him for his mathematics. They say he ventured even in fields like logic, philosophy, and physics. Was it good?
I think we'll have to draw matters to a conclusion at that point. I think the lesson that Professor Cartier has taught us is that there is a great deal more around what had seemed like clear and rather simple concepts than we'd thought. So thank you very much for that enlightenment, and can we thank him again?